This episode of Remnant Radio is brought to you in part by our sponsors at Kairos Classrooms. Have you ever thought about learning a biblical language as a supplemental tool in your biblical studies? Well, Kairos Classrooms offers real classroom environments with classmates and a live instructor who can help teach you biblical languages, both Greek and Hebrew. You need to check out Kairos Classrooms today. The price for a single semester is crazy affordable for anyone, so check out the links in the description and use promo code REMNANT to get 10% off Kairos Classrooms. Check out Kairos Classrooms today. Discount code REMNANT, REMNANT, to get 10% off your semester.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the wonderful world of Remnant Radio. In this program, we're talking about the greatest year in history, 1776. Everything that happened before it was an accident. It's going to be an exciting program. You guys stay tuned.
You are watching The Remnant Radio, a crowd-funded show where we interview pastors, teachers, historians, and theologians from different churches and denominations. My name is Joshua Lewis, and this is my co-host, Michael Roundtree. Together, we want to help you break outside of your theological echo chambers. If you're interested in learning about history, theology, or the gifts of the Spirit, this is the show for you.
Guys, I'll tell you what, I don't know what I'm going to say before we go live. Things just come out of my mouth. That was not premeditated at all. It's a Ron Swanson quote. Obviously, I love the crucifixion and the resurrection. Those things happened before 1776.
I was going to say, man.
Take it easy. Anyway, all that to say, guys, thank you so much for tuning into this program. We've got Andrew Wilson with us. We're talking about his new book that we are very interested in, really enjoyed reading. But before we dive into the subject, I want to remind you that Remnant Radio is entirely crowdfunded, and the best way to stay connected with us, support us, is subscribing to the newsletter. You can find the newsletter in the link of the description of this video. You link into it, you kind of find all the different things that we're doing, conferences, courses, videos that we're coming out with, all the different interesting interviews that are coming out in the next couple of weeks, months, that kind of thing. Without further ado, I want to introduce you to my co-host and our guest. This is Andrew on the left and Michael on the right. Michael, you excited about today's program? You're a longtime Andrew Wilson listener.
Reader, I am. All the above. Andrew, I am a fanboy of yours, and honestly, I love just everything you write. You write in such a, you're a wordsmith, and I have a great appreciation for that, but you also just have great things to say, and fitting into that word and spirit and sacrament space. Before the show, we were talking about this Venn diagram and kind of the coming together of these different streams. Well, for you, that's a small Venn diagram right there, word, spirit, sacrament, and something that we relate to a lot here at Remnant Radio because we're in that same vein. So anyway, super excited to have you on the show. And, you know, being that you are from the UK and you wrote a book about 1772.
How dare you? Being from the UK, write a book on 1776.
So I expect there's going to have to be some trash talk. I think my first question, Andrew, about 1776 is, are you still bitter?
To be honest, I feel like we got a great deal. We had this sort of non-taxpaying subsection of the colonies that decided they wanted to go their own way.
Okay. We went with
monarchy. And we got Her Majesty the Queen, you went with presidency, you went with the last few years, which are the side of the aisle you're on, and I feel like generally we're feeling pretty good about that exchange. So yeah, no hard feelings at all.
Yeah, it's not aging really well.
Queen Elizabeth was pretty great, I gotta say. She was pretty great. But my wife loves the crown. That's where our UK history comes from. Anyway,
rightly so. I mean,
okay. So, well, let's talk a little bit about your book. So, you wrote this book, "Remaking the World: How 1776 Created the Post-Christian West." So, it's not just a history book. It's how this particular date in history affected a whole bunch of other stuff. But that's like my tiny little nutshell. If you could maybe expand on that a little bit, what inspired you to write this book? And maybe just if you could elaborate on what this book is really about and who it's for.
Yeah, I'm trying to tell the story of how and why the West is in this, the position that we're in, and how we've got the ideology, the values, the assumptions that we do. And I'm trying to tell a very big story about that, which relates sort of economics and technology and geography to ideology and spirituality and education, and trying to get all of those things all in one big story. And in order to tell a really big story, you have to find a way of making it smaller. And so a lot of history books will say the history of the world through the story of the horse or the duck or an object or whatever, and they'll try and make the story small in some way. And this book is really attempts to do that by saying, let's narrow the field of vision to 1 year and say, let's use this 1 year as a way of telling a really what's a 2,000 year long story. But instead of telling a massive 2,000 year long story, which is going to go down all sorts of rabbit trails, instead just focus on 1 year and then try and tell the story about how the different transformations that have shaped the West to be what it is now are all embryonic and all emerging in that particular year, and how they all interact with each other so that people get a rounded vision of the kind of society we're in. And then towards the end of the book, what Christians do about that and how we live in and serve and understand a society in which those values and assumptions are predominant. So that's the basic conceit.
Well, you mentioned a moment ago, just governance, to stop at the top of the list, right? Government, religion, society, generally. Can you give us just a snapshot of that? Like how has 1776,
yeah,
how has that been a pattern that interprets the kind of modern West that we currently live in? And maybe even before we answer that question, maybe it'd be helpful to just say, a lot of people are going to say, okay, this happened a long time ago. This happened in the past. What the heck does that have to do with me now? Maybe contextualize how we are the product of that history as well.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's kind of a given that people are the product of history. At least it would seem very obvious to me. I think if you stop and think about it for a moment, it's obviously true for all of us. If you walk in halfway through a conversation, it's very irritating when you start chipping in without having understood where the conversation's already gone, because otherwise you feel like you're repeating things that have been said or misconstruing things that have been said or misunderstanding what people mean when they say dot, dot, dot. And so I think in a sense, going back 250 years is a bit like revisiting your own family history two or three generations back. You can't understand why you are the way you are without knowing why your grandparents or your great grandparents did or thought certain things, because those beliefs get transmitted through time. And I think in our culture, it's particularly important to do that because there are a lot of features of the modern West that make us much more amnesiac than most cultures would be. So if you go to scripture and you read a book like Genesis, you can't get through a few chapters without it stopping and saying, okay, here's a genealogy. Here's who was the father of who, father of who, father of who. And for us as Western people, those sections are always quite dull and we don't really know what to do with them. But most societies are like the Bible on this, not like us. Most societies say, this is your deep roots in time. This is your grandfather, your great grandfather. And so this is how to understand you are here and what that means. Our culture, because, I mean, even the very fact that we're doing this conversation on online recording, we're thousands of miles away from each other. This thing will disappear into the ether. People might or might not pick it up. They'll probably interact with it in some way, some cases using a phone, which is a device designed to sort of self-destruct within 3 years. And everything's, and then you'll immediately get assaulted by 1,000 other images before you have dinner tonight. And that kind of society is catechizing us all the time to go, forget everything that happened a minute before yesterday. And in a society like that, understanding why we came to be where we are is actually more important, not less, because it's so countercultural. People just don't think that way. And so that's the defense of why we have to do big history books, even sometimes going back several hundred years to understand why we are. And you're right. Government is a very good example because it's the American example, I guess. And because I think it's the main contribution that America makes in this year, in 1776, because it's not just that most countries in the world are democratic. It's not even, and most of them are voting this year, and you know, sort of billions of people going to elections this year. That would be in 1775, no one voted in elections. Mm-hmm. And today, nearly everybody in some sense does, even if it's a bit of a sham election. But I think there's six countries on earth that don't claim to be democratic. Now, obviously, many of the others, we might say, well, they're not really like America is. You might say the same of us. We've got a hereditary monarchy. But they would claim to be. They would say we are, in some sense, a democratic republic. And that doesn't just affect the way you do politics. It affects your norms and your expectations. It affects the fact that you and I think that choice is sacrosanct, not only of political outcomes, but of marriage partners or breakfast cereals or career choices or universities or where to live. And most people in history just have never thought like that. They don't think, I need to choose this guy. They often wouldn't choose their marriage partner, let alone what kind of town they lived in, trade. You do the same thing as your dad did. He teaches you how to do it. It's not an issue for them. And in our culture, choice is like almost one of the highest values, to the point that in some debates, people can elevate choice as if it's almost alongside life as one of the things that you must be in favor of. And you think, wow, how did that come in? And the answer is, well, it in part came in through our political processes, and particularly through political processes on your side of the Atlantic, which have now taken root in so many areas of life that we don't even question them, not just in politics, but many other areas too. So it's a very good example of how an event 250 years back is shaping the ordinary decisions you and I make about toothpaste and romance and whatever a long time later.
And I could see that being positive and negative, like positive in the sense that personal responsibility is probably thrust to the forefront, but then negative in the sense that like hyper Western individualism can plague the church, right? Like we can just be turned into consumeristic, capitalistic sort of consumer, let's go and get the best new cool thing. I think that's helpful. It's a helpful way of like conceptualizing, okay, 1776 has shaped the Western mind in this way. Roger, I didn't mean to interrupt you, man.
No, you're good. You know, so Andrew, one of the points you make in your book, it's about a president that probably a lot of Americans don't even know he was a president, John Tyler. Okay. So you talk about how John Tyler's presidency, like his life story, mirrors historical trends. And then you start talking about his descendants and their achievements and how these highlight historical continuity. So I guess my question is, why do you bring up John Tyler? What, who is he, and what was his relevance to the historical discussion?
So I bring him up because I just think it's one of the best facts in the modern world that the 10th president of the United States, whose parents got married in 1776, has a living grandson. I just find it so staggering. And every time I hear that fact, I find myself astonished that it's true. That the guy who he was, so he's born during the French Revolution, he becomes president, he signs into law the annexation of Texas, and he has a grandson who's still alive now. And so there, or put the other way, there is a guy alive now whose father was on the side of the Confederacy in the Civil War and whose grandfather owned 70 slaves. And I just find that sort of, you know, and he, but there's a guy, he's still alive now, and he's seen Black Lives Matter. He's seen Barack Obama. He's just these astounding transformations in the space of two generations. Now, obviously, for most of us, they're much longer than two generations because most of us have kids at the age of 30 rather than the age of 60 or 70. But if you did happen to have two generations, that's all it is, two generations worth of people who either got married or had kids very late, your grandfather or your great-grandfather, if you're our age, could have been, you know, alive with the founding fathers. And so I tell the story because I want people to see how concertinaed the past is. It can feel like a theme park, particularly the way that you guys do your national history, your pageantry. Obviously for us, no offense, but 1776 is British people. Everybody who'd heard I'd written this book in Britain is going, what's that year? What's special about that? Which year is it again? 1768, was it? It's a meaningless number to them. Sure. But on your side of the Atlantic, it's obviously profoundly important. And you do celebrate it in a way that has a lot of almost mythical character for obvious reasons. You know, you celebrate it with fireworks and you can go to colonial towns and see people enact things and you have Civil War reenactments. And then sometimes we might have Revolutionary War reenactments. And it's all a bit of a thing. And so it can feel a bit unreal. It feels like a magical kingdom rather than a real place where our ancestors lived. And so for me, telling that story of this three-generation family from John Tyler to his son, to his grandson, and seeing the social and technological change they've experienced in just three generations is a way of trying to make it real. And obviously, they are not the only people who lived to the age of 70, 80, or 90 in those periods. And they witnessed just earth-shattering levels of historical transformation, which it can help to remind people of and make people just, this is real. This really happened. And these kind of things have only really spanned two or three lifetimes. And they're very, very real. And they are, in that sense, like your great-grandparents. They, even if you don't remember your great-grandparents' names, they shape you to this day. And you are the person you are because of them. And the same is true of us as a society as a whole. So they are just a convenient family as a way of telling that extraordinary story.
Andrew, this is you know, we talked about governance, maybe just as we're kind of like setting the foundations for our discussion, can you talk about like the seven different transformative works that you kind of record in your book to say, hey, these are the seven specific areas that I think have been, and not that that is an exhaustive list, but these are the areas that I can witness and say there's been dramatic transformations in these areas because of this year. Now, you mentioned, like you said, 1776, that's important for Americans, but there were other things happening all over the world that happened in 1776 that seemed to shift the whole Western mind very drastically. So could you maybe unpack some of this for us?
Yeah, sure. So I the seven stories I'm trying to tell that are interlocking really are the stories of globalization, the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, the great enrichment, so the dramatic increase of wealth, obviously the story of democracy, which we've touched on, the story of the abandonment of formerly of Christianity or post-Christianity, trying to move beyond it and not really succeeding, and the story of romanticism in the arts and music and in the percolating through to our understanding of the self. And those seven stories, I kind of try and blend them together by using this acronym WEIRDER, which is just might probably worth introducing because it's really central to what I'm trying to do. And I think it's a helpful way of thinking about our society to say that our society is WEIRDER. We are Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic, ex-Christian, and romantic. And that acronym summarizes a sort of spiritual, technological, material, environmental, geographical, educational factors to intellectual, you know, to try and explain who we are. And what I then do is I then go, all right, so 1776 is a year in which you can see all of these things kicking off. And the American Revolution is a very obvious one in politics, leading to our being democratic today. And I don't have any chip on my shoulder about this. I say, no, were it not for not only America, but actually a handful of remarkable individuals in America, had George Washington not done what he did, or Thomas Jefferson and Tom Paine not been as talented as they were rhetorically, or John Adams not been as curmudgeonly as he was, we might not have democracy having taken the form that it has, if at all, globally. And I think that is astonishing. And your nation is obviously to be thanked and or blamed for that having happened. But there's many other things, as you say, taking place at the same time. So the Industrial Revolution, so my country, the main thing that's going on in the 1770s is the Industrial Revolution. The sort of 1776 is the year that James Watt's steam engine starts running at the Bloomfield Colliery. And within 30 years, you have the beginnings of what we would now think of as steam trains. And within 60 years, you have, in Britain at least, you have enormous explosion in economic growth and railways everywhere, very, very rapidly accelerating, and a massive uptick in financial implications for that. And obviously that's got implications for my nation, but it was quickly then slapped all over much of the rest of the world as well, leading to a very different kind of world now than we had before. But that's the industrial change I mentioned. But then you've got the same economic changed. You know, Adam Smith in 1776 wrote The Wealth of Nations. And in part, he was trying to explain why wealth was stuck and what people should do about it. And without realizing it, he is writing this book as wealth is beginning to dramatically change, particularly in the country he's writing in, namely Britain, but very quickly in many, many other countries as well. And I want to tell that story and say, look, this, you know, human society had basically lived at roughly the same standard of GDP per person for thousands and thousands of years. And then in the middle of the 1770s, it started shooting upwards and it hasn't stopped rising since. I want to talk about globalization. So I talk about Captain Cook and his voyage in 1776. I want to talk about romanticism. So I talk about Rousseau and Goethe and many of these other guys who are writing and what they're saying in 1776. I want to talk about post-Christianity. And so I talk about Edward Gibbon and Voltaire and Diderot and the Marquis de Sade and many of the ways in which people tried to overthrow God in 1776. And so that's what the book is. It's really a series of seven stories like that, drilling down on these individual narratives and these moments in 1776, and then saying that story is why the culture you're in now looks, feels, smells, thinks the way it does. And so, yeah, government was a good example, but there's many others to tell. And it's the way that they are all colliding together that I think makes it such an interesting story.
That's great.
Okay, so there's a huge collision of these movements beginning in 1776, but here we are in 2024, and it feels like another huge collision. So So what does that mean? Did these streams, like, did they increase and increase and increase and increase, and now they're colliding? Like, help us understand kind of this cultural moment growing out of that one, because they seem like two almost crisis moments, two convergences of lots of things happening at one time. So help us understand the relationship between what feels like crisis today, I think I can say that, to what was crisis then.
So I think obviously crisis is, as you would know, is just a fascinating word, because it can mean disaster. That's often how we use it, but it can also mean a sort of a judgment moment, a moment where things sort of like a fork in the road, a bit of a dramatic change. And I think in that sense, 1776 was a crisis. I don't think it was a crisis in the sense of being a disaster, not even really for the British, who obviously lost, but within a few years of trading happening with America. And in fact, but in time, we're overtaking France, and actually they're much more prosperous in the 19th century than we were before. So it wasn't a disaster in that sense. And actually, I think I would also challenge the idea that it's a crisis in that sense today as well. That is, it's a harder case to make. We might come on to that. But what I'm trying to do in the book, I think, is to anchor the what feels like a very turbulent crisis-y period in our own day, and try and anchor that in a much larger story that shows these things that feel like they're coming out of nowhere and people feel a bit punch drunk by the change are actually the products of much longer, more incremental historical development that need not freak everybody out in quite the way that they often do. And I think what happens in our own generation is partly because of the obsessive novelty and amnesia that I touched on a few minutes ago, that people feel mugged by current events in a way that in many generations they simply wouldn't even have been aware that they were happening. So, for instance, people often say the unprecedented level of animosity and mudslinging in public debate in politics would be an example. I don't want to get myself into trouble on things I don't really know much about. But I don't think, I mean, obviously, that, and as a Brit, I joked earlier, I sometimes look with a degree of you know, comic timing at some of the things that some of your leaders say to each other or about each other. And obviously I know some of it is more serious than that. And particularly, you know, January 6th or something like that. But even then, I go back to the 1790s and the way and the pamphlet wars then, and the level of, I think the Republic came closer to collapsing under its own weight in the 1790s than it did in in 2016 or in 2021 or whatever. And I might even be wrong about that, but that would be my study would suggest to me this was a more grave crisis for the nation in a sense. And obviously, I would say the same of the 1860s. And so, I think in some ways, what I'm trying to do by telling the story is not to say, hey, it's more run of the mill than we think. There is a sometimes like narcissism in us that we will see our own generation as the pivotal moment. Of course, everyone does and thinks this is the moment it's all coming to a head. And actually that on some of the things which feel most surprising, like the very sudden transformation in ethics with regard to sex, sexuality, marriage, the body, the self, which feels like it's actually happened in about 10 years, is it really another story in the book? Is tracking really a story that goes back to the 1770s? Which is not to say that everyone just goes, yeah, well, you see, fine, you just get along. It's just the next step and it's inevitable or anything. But it is to say, we just need to sometimes calm down. That this is not as out of nowhere. It's often, I think, one of the reasons why conspiracy theories appeal in moments of social change is because people are trying to get control of the narrative. They're trying to think, oh, this is how I can make sense of this very unsettling process. And I think history is in many ways a better way of doing that. It's telling that story in a way that says this actually, the sex revolution you're experiencing now in your state in many ways was already, you know, fully down this, a long way down this line, at least in some pockets of society in your nation by the late 60s. And actually in many cases it was in the late 20s. And if you really wanted to push the point, you could go back to the 1770s and see the same thing. And so I'm not sure I can connect the crisis in quite that way, but I'm hoping by telling the story the way I have to make sense of our moment in a way that doesn't see it as a singular epochal crisis, but rather as the product of a lot of much longer term factors, of which our generation is having a particular version of that dialogue. And as someone's, I think, already said, many of those changes are in fact positive and not negative for us anyway. Very few of us, if given the choice, would like to go back.
It's good. It's good. I want to, if and when Andrew's screen freezes again, I'm going to cut the camera to me and do like a sepia tone and like mime his gestures. So he'll talk and I will just kind of mime the whole thing, pretending to be him. That'll be a lot of fun. No, totally joking. I'd like to know how the weirder, the language of Western educated, individualized, how is it, rich, democratic, ex-Christian, romantic, that weirdness, how that affects Christian culture today. I know that that dives probably much further along in our conversation. However, as a theology podcast, looking for that intersection of history and theology and those kinds of things, I'm curious, how does this evolve the worldview? I mean, Christianity has existed, right, 2,000 years, and it seems as if 1,700 of that seems to be rooted in this non-individualistic, non-romantic worldview, and now we exist in something else. Is our goal as Christians to get people to think in a different worldview? Is our, like, what kind of challenges does this worldview offer up to Christianity? I found your book very, very helpful. Well partnered with Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, like it was a good pairing, I would say. Could you weigh in on that? Because I'm really interested.
I'm honored that you'd read them together. And I'm obviously, I read Carl's work and had dialogue with him personally about it while I was working on the book, because I think I'm a more optimistic person and probably feel like there's more positives to say about the developments, and he's telling a different story. But there is a lot of overlap. First thing to say is you mentioned romanticism and individualism as two examples. I think romanticism is a much newer development, stemming back to the late 18th century. Individualism, I think, has been at least a 1,000-year process in the West, and in many ways goes back to Augustine's Confessions and before him, Paul, people who begin to write about the inner journey of it. I think Romans 7 is, or Augustine's Confessions are just extraordinary texts that, if you leave them in a society long enough, are going to lead people to start really having serious questions about how they as an individual feel and take personal responsibility for their lives and outcomes and probing their own motives and things. So I think in a way that is a much more obviously Christian development. Romanticism is a little different, because I think romanticism is unimaginable without Christianity and without that emphasis on the individual, but it's a particular form of almost like, there's a sort of surging rebellious response to certain aspects of the Christian moral framework on account of other aspects of the Christian moral framework. So it's a very interesting development. And this is why I said I'm probably a bit more optimistic about it than someone like Carl, because I think I can see how not only the downsides, obviously, as he highlights very clearly, but I can see that many of the reasons why romanticism is what it is, and the reasons why it's changed the way we think and the way that it in the way it has, is also a result of Christian impulses within it, and it wouldn't have come about without the church. And that, if I'm to broaden out to the bigger question you're asking about how does the church respond, one of the challenges for the church in responding to many of these developments is that several of them, I think, are the result of Christian influence that have then made practicing confessional Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, much harder. So Christianity is its own gravedigger, is the line one historian or sociologist uses.
Yeah, could you illustrate that? I love early on in the book, you just talked about someone flogging the Christian with their worldview, and the Christian going, wait a second, that's my stick. Could you unpack that a little bit for us? Because I thought that was extremely helpful to make sense of you have these presuppositions that I gave you. Anyway.
Yeah, I got that from Chris Watkin, actually, after I'd written the book. I heard him say, who wrote Biblical Critical Theory, I heard him say that. It's like you're being just being beaten with the stick for being bigoted and intolerant and annoyed. And you eventually you're being taking the pounding. And then suddenly, hang on a second, that's my stick. The reason that the Christian is being attacked by things is because the Christian has, or Christianity has, bequeathed these moral norms to society as a whole. And so the reason why we believe that the weak things of the world will shame the strong, and those who are not in positions of power need to be lifted up, and the mighty need to be brought down from their seat, and the humble and meek should be exalted, and the slave actually gets to rule over the emperor. And it's all in the cross. It's all in the Magnificat. It's all in the letter of James or Isaiah or whatever. And in Hannah's song in 1 Samuel. And, so I found that, I think Chris's, hey, that's my stick, has really helped me just capture it with a funny line. But that's exactly the phenomenon I'm trying to draw attention to, not only when it comes to our moral values, but actually take another very different example, our wealth. So one of the stories I tell in the book is about the relationship between the great enrichment and Christianity, and not just Christianity, actually, but sectarian Protestant Christianity, nonconformism. I imagine you guys are nonconformists yourselves. I am. But people who are, you know, but it is disproportionately the discoveries and inventions and things that change the levels of wealth dramatically in the Western world are mostly a product of Protestant nations and nonconformist people within Protestant nations. And for very important reasons, they're connected to Protestant developments like literacy and a belief that the future will be better than the past, which is based on our eschatology, and a preference for novelty over antiquity, which is based on our anthropology and our doctrine of sin. And so many things like that mean that actually the wealth in the Western world that we experience in so many ways is in much of it, not all of it, much of it is related to our Christian roots. And there's many other factors too, but that's one. But one of the, what that's done, of course, is wealth and the industrial technology that's come gone with it has actually made practicing Christianity much harder, because it's meant that societies have become much more atomized and individualized. And it means people don't only not go to church like they used to, they don't even belong to pretty much any corporate translocal body like a union or a club or a local society, the little platoons that Edmund Burke used to talk about. So many of those kind of, you know, entities in which lots of individuals find purpose beyond themselves, not just a church, but all of them, have almost disintegrated in the modern West. Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone kind of idea. And so in many ways, Christianity has made the world richer, which has then made practicing Christianity harder. It's made families smaller. It's made people less religious. The same is true, as we've said, of values like, you know, tolerance and the opposition of, you know, power against, you know, compassion and those sorts of things. But that idea that you should, that love is the greatest value, that, you know, when as soon as you see anyone saying love means love or whatever, I saw someone, you know, walk into the coffee shop the other day tattooed with rainbow colored love means love on their leg. I think, well, I can probably tell your politics and your sexual ethics, but actually you've taken 1 Corinthians 13 and the centrality of love from the Bible, and then you turned it into a moral framework all by itself, which now sounds like it's in opposition to the Bible in our culture. And so those are two very different examples, one about sort of sexuality, romance, and ideology, and the other about material wealth, invention, and technology. But both of them see Christianity effectively give rise to something that then makes being a Christian more difficult. And there are many other examples in the book, I hope. And that's why I think it's such a challenging, it's a fun story, but it's a challenging environment for Christians to negotiate, because you can't just say, we should never have made this move. We should never have gone there. We should never have lifted up the individual. We should never have exalted the humble. No. That's, we should have done those things, but we are now facing some of the consequences, which are not what we or the people who were writing on our behalf 200 years ago ever envisioned or wanted. And that makes it a challenging thing to negotiate for us, although it creates opportunities as well, which I'm sure we can talk about.
It's interesting. When you preach, everything that is said is reminding you of something you're preaching, right? So having gone through Habakkuk, the letter starts off going about the law of God being twisted and manipulated. And because the twisting of the law, justice never goes forth. And what you're describing is the Christian ethic is then being twisted. And because of that twisting, like what goes forth is perversion. The assumption is therefore there's something wrong with the law. No. There's something wrong with the human heart that's twisting it. I think that's a helpful illustration there. Yeah. Roundtree.
Yeah, sure. So, Andrew, I'm going to ask a question that is going to probably give you like five jumping in points and just take any one of them you want. But I really want to zero in on the phrase ex-Christian, the E of weirder. And, you know, in America, there's this debate in evangelical circles of like, were we founded as a Christian nation or were we founded by a bunch of deists? And, you know, it goes back and forth and everyone's like, George Washington prayed this. And they're like, yeah, but George Washington was a deist and a Mason. And, you know, on and on the battle goes. But, you know, like one side's like, we were founded as a Christian nation. We were super Christian for all of these years. And then like in 2015, we started to go like postmodern and now we're starting to abandon our Christian values. What I hear you saying is that the ex-Christian badge was there, at least at its inception, from the very inception of our nation. So that's one jumping in point. Feel free to comment on that, but I'm going to kind of flower that out into a very recent Twitter controversy, or social platform formerly known as Twitter, now X. I don't know if you saw this, Andrew, but there was in America, it was flying around everywhere that it was on MSNBC, and there was a woman who claimed that if you believe that your rights come from God, you're a Christian nationalist. And all the Christians jump on it and they're like, well, I guess Thomas Jefferson's a Christian nationalist because he says that our rights come from God in the Declaration of Independence. And then there was this big flurry. And so, one, you can comment on the first half of the question I already talked about in the founding of our nation and ex-Christian and kind of where you stand on that. But also, this conversation on Twitter about like how we've now reached a place where media personalities are saying government is actually that which grants us our rights and anything otherwise is Christian nationalism. Maybe just how does all of that fit into the trajectory of ex-Christian as you see it?
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing, that ex-Christian as a label is deliberately provocative. It's trying to get people to think through the sense in which we are ex-Christian and the things in which we're ex-Christian, as in we've moved beyond Christianity but not beyond Islam or communism or whatever, as in we are, it's a Christian society that we have tried to move beyond, and that makes us very different from societies that have moved beyond something else. I think to go to the founding father, I mean, the reason why people say all of those different things is about the founding fathers is because they're all true. And I think the idea that the founding fathers must have been sort of monolithic or broadly on the same page when it came to some of these issues is just crackers. If you read their letters and read their treatises and some very explicit arguments and often quite bad-tempered ones between them. If you read even just in 1776, you read Thomas Paine and John Adams responding to each other's arguments in some of the things they're writing, even in the very start of the revolution. They clearly strongly disagree about all manner of things. And you see that same disagreement. I mean, to be honest, it's enacted beautifully in Hamilton, which is, you know, just a very good way of telling that story in a fun, lively way. But the reason why those cabinet battles and all the shout outs are going on in the way they are in that show is because that's what happened. So you've got this very wide range. You've got some people who are zealous conservative Presbyterian Christians. You've got zealous conservative Baptist Christians who want to make sure that their religious rights are protected. The New Englanders are very different from the Virginians and then from the full-on Southerners. You've got differences on whether or not there is a God that you can take for granted, whether there's a God that you should worship, whether there may not even be a God, but we need to believe that we use theological language anyway. But the reality is that all of the founding fathers, whether they were pretty stridently not Christian or very stridently Christian, and there was lots of disagreement about those things, but they were all operating within a framework where what we now understand as rights, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness being things given to a creator. That wasn't in question, even if people weren't 100% sure that they wanted to worship that creator, or whether they would, had no one cared where they were on a Sunday, whether they would have actually been in corporate worship with the saints, or whether they prayed, or whether they attempted to honor God in their moral life. And even when they didn't, they're still operating in a shared framework of assumptions that derive very much from Christianity. And you can see this even in someone like Thomas Jefferson, who is obviously on the more sort of not Christian end of that spectrum. He's a complicated guy, but But actually, you read even when Jefferson is writing drafting the Declaration, he's taking the language from John Locke, and John Locke is taking the language from Richard Hooker, who's an Anglican theologian, and he's Hooker's taken the language really from the Bible and the Code of Justinian, and going way back. And so, even these famous phrases in the Declaration in your country are, which sound very neutral religiously speaking, are very saturated in Christian assumptions. And so the reality is, when some people say, but this founding father wasn't a Christian and thought it had nothing to do with God, and someone else says, this founding father said it because they loved the Lord God with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength, then they're probably both right about different founding fathers and about different times. The ones who generally in a more progressive, not very Christian space in our day-to-day get more of the headlines would be understandably the founding fathers who line up that way, the sort of the Franklins and the Jeffersons, and the guys who are more conservative, obviously in the more conservative circles. But they're all, the point is, they're all operating within Christian assumptions about things like sin, creation, providence, whether or not the person in question believes everything in the Bible is true, which Jefferson clearly did not. So I think that's the way I'd come at that debate. I think that the way it's framed now, in the sense of we used to be a Christian country, now we've not, is often more a politically loaded rhetorical strategy to try and tell a story of decline and fall with particular political agendas in mind. And it's not my place to adjudicate on those. I don't share them, being British and being more, you know, probably well to the left in that sense of most Americans anyway, because we have free healthcare, free education, all that. You know, so I'm British, so give me a pass on some of those things. But I think that behind the debate is often a more explicitly political, rhetorical motive. And that what almost all political narratives do is to out there is a hero and a villain, and there's an eschatology and a shape to the story in which there's a crisis moment. And obviously in your country, a lot of people more on the right would look back to sort of 50s and 80s, and a lot of people more on the left might look back to 60s and 70s. And it sort of depends on the story as you tell it, where the moment that it all went wrong is. And everyone does it, and I don't think any party is immune to that desire to tell the story that way. But I don't think it's really based in reality in a sort of monolithic set of founding father assumptions about God. I don't think you could possibly read John Witherspoon and Thomas Paine and say, yeah, these guys believe the same kind of thing about God. That's just nonsense. They miles away. But they nevertheless committed to the same sort of vision of a state and the same sort of vision of what America could become. And I think is in its way very impressive, given the divergence on matters of God and many, many other things. So that's kind of how I'd want to come at that. When it comes to this woman, I am afraid I was offline. I haven't been on Twitter for the last few weeks because I've taken some time out. But yeah, it's undoubtedly true that the founding fathers thought that the rights that were given, I mean, everyone knows that, that the rights had been given by their creator, and to see them as a product of a government rather than the product of a God is a move that, were people to accept it, would have dramatic implications, not only for public debate in America, but for the way that all democracies function. Yeah. I don't think you would ever get the moral impulse for democracy were it not for Christian assumptions about what God had given and even the dignity of individuals, which come from Christian thought. But I didn't see the debate, so I wouldn't want to comment more on that.
Man, what a wonderfully nuanced answer. Let's see if you can navigate this next question with the same level of carefulness.
I have a question. The name of the show.
He already knows which ones I'm going to ask. I'm sure we're in the same working document that I have one highlighted. I'm curious about, you mentioned earlier how the kind of reversal of the kingdom, the gospel brings the high low and the low high. And then kind of in response to the, you know, the neo-Marxist proletariat and the bourgeoisie that we're seeing in the woke movement, like how do you thread that needle and say, this is like good Christian ethic, this is too far? How do Christians navigate this space of saying, yes, there is a value of equality, of true egalitarianism, if you will, between those in power and those who do not have power. And there's an elevation of dignity, value, and worth of all humanity. And yet at the same time, and maybe you disagree with me on this issue, but I don't know. Well, let's see. That there need not be a kind of social revolution of 1776 where violence and bloodshed takes place to take power back. I'd be curious what your take on that is.
So basically, give us your take on wokeness and intersectionality in 3 minutes or something, right? That's the gist of the question.
I mean, yes, please.
So I actually wrote a long-ish paper and sort of published this article on I think it was called Wokeness Oppression, Privilege, Intersectionality, and the Church, or something like that, a few years ago, because I was seeing this early, I mean, early-ish, while this debate was blowing up in your country, I was increasingly, and in mine to some degree as well. I found the language of wokeness very annoying, because I'm a pastor in a black majority church where that word was introduced to me literally 7 years ago. I had never heard it before. And it had a very clear meaning within the black community of awareness about racial injustice. And it's just very quickly gone from that to meaning almost any. Now it's a word that's used more by people who don't like it than people who do, and it's become almost a bucket and bogeyman term for people on the more sort of conservative side to say, look at all this nonsense that you hear from these jokers. And so I don't like that particular word, but I do think intersectionality as a framework is quite a good term to use for the broad power dynamics I think that you're talking about, that you really have multiple axes, that there are people with more privilege and power at one end and less on the other end. And that a large part, and that someone like me, you know, white, male, educated, all this stuff, wealthy, relative terms, historically, have a lot of privilege, and then some people have very little privilege. And that one of the things we have to do is redress that and make sure that we lift up the voices of those who have less, and where necessary, make social changes to reflect it and make sure that the rights of those who are the less privileged are protected. And I think when framed like that, you'd say that's a very Christian idea. It does grow out of the Magnificat, and it does come out of the Sermon on the Mount and many things Jesus says, in the sense that, you know, we try and lift up the humble and bring down. I think the reason why, so I think it's in outline is actually a very obviously quite a Christian vision in what it's attempting to do. I think the challenges where they come are more methodological, and particularly I think in the excessive emphasis on the relationship of power and inadequate emphasis on relationships of love. So, and it's Chris Watkin again, but he really helped me with this, because he was saying how for him that in a sense what Foucault did with power in the 60s and 70s is in a way what Augustine had done with love in The City of God, which is to say, I'm now going to read the history of what has happened in the world and the way human beings associate together through the lens of, in Foucault's case, power, and in Augustine's case, love. Now, of those two, Christians have to be very aware of power dynamics. They exist even in this very conversation, let alone all our everyday interactions. But we don't believe that that is the fundamental lens through which we should see God. We say God is powerful, but ultimately God is love. We would say the role, the relationship that takes place within a marriage, there might be an imbalance of power, and in many marriages there has been, but ultimately this is a relationship of love. You'd say parents have power over children, but ultimately love is a more important lens through which to view it. And one of the things that when it's untethered from other Christian assumptions, the intersectionality framework, if you want to call it wokeness or whatever, that's fine. One of the when you get problems, which we have in recent years, well, one of the reasons those problems arise is because the power grid is being used exclusively, and the love grid, and of course there are other grids we could use too, has been marginalized to such an extent that it doesn't really get a look in. So we see a relationship taking place between someone, you know, two people at work, or two people in a church, or two people in government, or two people in a family, and we apply power relations to it as if that's the most important thing to say about that relationship, rather than what do these people love, what is their God, what is their highest love, what's their highest joy, what's the telos of that love, where is it going in history, how should that love best be expressed given the other obligations they have and the other things they love. And that I think is a more fruitful way of Christianizing the call to exalt the humble and, you know, bring down the mighty. So to the extent that the Magnificat gives us a program for social action, which I don't think entirely is its purpose, by the way, but to the extent that there are clearly things that have great implications, as both of Mary's boys, Jesus and James, spell out in their teaching in the New Testament, there are implications for us for the way that we live socially with one another. But to the extent that that's needed at all, it needs to be done, I think, through the love framework has got to predominate over the power one, and there are others we should bring in as well. And so broadly speaking, I think intersectionality, it has a lot to be said for it from a Christian perspective. And I think the Bible even engages in bits of it, actually. I think the reason why we know that there's captured this enslaved girl in Philippi in Acts 16. She's being exploited. She's being oppressed. She's demonized. She has got lots of intersecting, overlapping disadvantages. And that's why we're being told the story about her that we are. And that's why Paul brings freedom to her in the way that he does. So I think this is a mean of Ruth I'm preaching on Sunday. She would be another example of multiple overlapping discriminations that she experiences. So I think the framework has a lot to be said for it from a Christian point of view. But when it is read simply through the lens of power, and when it's provided then as a social program to redress the power without thinking about people's loves, people's gods, people's worship, people's highest joys, it ends up being can be a very distorting lens through which to view what's taking place in the world.
Okay.
For someone who answered a question in 3 minutes, I mean, that's about as good as it gets, right?
Yeah. So of course, I mean, you see in the scripture, you see in the Good Samaritan, you see in the woman at the well, and all of these people who are on the fringes, people who are disenfranchised for very reasons, socioeconomically, ethnically, religiously, in all various ways. And in modern terms, the word intersectionality might be applied to this person's gender, this person's race, this person's this and that. And so I hear you in that, and I hear you saying power dynamics, they're for sure real. Everyone has to admit that they're real. You would just say that as Christians, we're not looking at that as the fundamental way of viewing humanity, if I'm hearing you right. Now, here's what I want to ask you, and feel free to correct me if I summarized you wrongly. But what I want to ask you is, let's take intersectionality, the intersectionality of gender and race and sexuality and all of these things, okay? Intersectionality is as well as CRT, the critical race theory, or even more broadly, critical theory, where power dynamics basically are the fundamental way of viewing every human interaction. In the context of your book, where you're tracking the historical trajectory to where we are today, very few people knew what CRT was 10 years ago, and quite honestly, not really very many people know what it is today, but we at least know the words. So how did 1776 get us to a place where critical theory or critical race theory and intersectionality are a huge part of the conversation?
So I think in many ways, I'd say this and then work out why it's true in a moment, but I would think that in some ways, all seven of the transformations that I'm talking about in the book feed into the debate that, particularly in York, CRT as a phrase is much less common in my country, but certainly all the debates that kicked off, particularly just after the death of George Floyd, I think you could see all seven of those transformations I talk about in the book feeding into it. So globalization, obviously, the fact that the American culture wars have been exported all over the world, and that people are doing things in Holland or New Zealand or Romania or whatever that are related to, and even using language that doesn't really have an analogy in that country, but people start using France or whatever, they're doing things in Paris that reflect what's happening in Detroit or San Francisco. That's a function of globalization, which is obviously, I'm tracking back to 1776. The Enlightenment was huge because I think, which is the second big trend I look at in the book, because obviously in massively raising the privilege and esteem placed on higher education and in trying to get a bottom-up narrative for how knowledge works and how human beings find flourishing in this life, rather than revelation, it's bottom-up. That has profoundly changed the way that everybody thinks in Western society, and particularly the way that more elites, which is where the frameworks like this are coming from, and that's particularly come in a more atheistic key in France and Germany, which is obviously where critical theory has often been developed, and all the people we're referring to here, Adorno, Horkheimer, Foucault, whatever, are coming out of that kind of context. And so I think you could see the influence of the Enlightenment. I think you could see the influence of industrialization and wealth, in the sense that there's no way that you would have the conversations we are having about, you know, what sort of obligations people who have advantaged owe to those who have been disadvantaged by the historical changes in the last 200 years. You just wouldn't be having those conversations were our culture not as rich and as industrialized and slightly guilty of feeling guilty about it as we are. And obviously much of the journey of enrichment in the West was not only exclusively. And I tell this story, I hope, in a nuanced way, but it's certainly the way it came about was through a whole bunch of expropriation and resource extraction and death and killing and enslavement and all sorts of things, which have terrible consequences today. So again, you could see those stories feeding into what we now understand the debate to be. We've talked about democracy and the emphasis on choice, and the post-Christianity we've touched on as well in a number of ways. And then romanticism in the valorization of the self and the importance of me being who I want to be. And I think if you were to put those seven stories together and then say, now, without knowing anything about what's happened recently, what would you think this would mean for a society's dialogue on privilege, race, sexuality, and so on? I don't think it would take a huge leap of the imagination to say, well, something like the debates that have been taking place in the West in the last 10 years might be the result of those seven changes. And so obviously, I didn't tell the story that way around. What I've done is, knowing that those things are all going on, I'm writing the book during lockdowns in my country. So I'm obviously very aware. I'm partly telling the story I am because I'm living in a society where these are the things being debated, and trying to say these are very closely connected to these way, way deeper trends than you think. But I do think there is a value in telling that story. I know we're going to finish in a moment, but this is part of the rationale for not just my book, but books that attempt to do this sort of thing, like Carl Truman's, like Chris Watkins, like many others. Because I think in telling people this is how we got here, you give people some power and agency over it. You help people see this is not suddenly come out of nowhere in 2015. You can't just blame the other political tribe for the fact this is a debate. You can't put this at the feet of the activist who persuaded so-and-so of whatever. You have to see these things have been simmering in society for a long time. And the fact that you say, own your home, believe you should be able to choose your marriage partner, and believe that you should be able to choose whether to have kids or not. If you can't have kids, you have IVF. If you can have kids, then you should use contraception. All of those things are related to the developments of the sexual revolution that you might not like so much taking place in your kid's school and in the bathroom that people are told to use in the gym or whatever. And you might like some of those developments and not like others, but they are of a piece with each other. And that story is quite a long one that requires some thought to reflect on and unpick. So that's really a quick apologetic, I suppose, for why my book or books like that try and do this are attempting to help serve the church by telling that story in a long enough way that people can see, oh, this thing I love and this thing I don't love actually bundled together in ways I can't separate in the tribal way that I might want to. And some people will probably find that very annoying, and some I hope will love it, but that's the attempt.
I think it was fantastic, because again, it's not a demonization of all culture, but to say this is how these thoughts came about. In the same way that we can say hyper-Western individualism has, I think, done more harm than good in the church, I would venture to say. At the same token, I can see the benefits of democracy in that regard. So like, it has caused some good and it has caused some bad. And then certainly you can say of Western democracy, it's caused problems as well. So it's none of it's flawless. Sin affects everything. So Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'd like to do this thing we try to do, where we do closing thoughts. I'm gonna toss it over to Michael Rowntree and ask him to kind of give a golden nugget thing that he's walking away with. He wants people walking away with, thinking about, meditating on, that kind of thing. I encourage people to pick up Andrew's book. I'm going to put a link of it in the description of the video. Actually, I'm going to put a link of it in the newsletter. My marketing lady's like, hey, one link. We got one link in that description. So click the description of the video, the newsletter, and we'll get you a link to Andrew's book online. Michael Rowntree, give me your kind of closing thought for this program.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm just reflecting on just history and the fact that so much of the Bible is history. You know, something like 40-50% of the Old Testament is history. You've got the first four books of the New Testament plus Acts is history. And I think that we tend to focus on like Paul's epistles and like, just give me the theology. And I love the theology, but the theology grows out of the history. And Christianity is a religion rooted in the historical fact that Jesus lived and he came and he preached the good news to the poor, and people hated him, and he was crucified under Pontius Pilate, and 3 days later, after being buried, he rose from the dead, continued to proclaim the good news for 40 more days. Afterward, he ascended to the right hand of the Father, and the church in history spread out to the four corners of the earth, and that's still playing out in modern times, which will tomorrow be history. And so I just say all of that because what Andrew is talking about is he's stepping into a way of thinking that is a biblical way of thinking. And that is, we didn't just appear like dots on a radar. We stand on fathers and grandfathers and mothers and grandmothers and all the way back. And the story matters because the story paints a trajectory. And there's a trajectory of the church throughout the world and throughout history, and church history matters. That's why we say we're about history and theology. And people are like, "Yeah, just give me the theology." Some of them, and we're like, "Well, they kind of, they both matter." And so I think the same is true in this. And in this, we didn't just arrive at this point in history because of a few radicals that showed up and wrote some bad stuff. We've been growing toward this. And so I just think it's important to study history because it gives us a trajectory. And for us as Christians, we don't just believe in philosophy and neat ideas because we just had the best teacher. I mean, we do have the best teacher, but we have the only teacher who rose from the dead in history. So I think those would be my thoughts. How about you, Andrew?
Well, I've just so enjoyed, obviously I've talked about my book loads in the last 6 months, which is a weird experience, but what I have really enjoyed about this conversation, I think that sort of riff we did off on contemporary, both politics, but then the discussion about intersectionality and so on, to me was just a helpful thing to re-engage and join together something that I haven't thought about as much since about 2021. With something I've been thinking about a lot more recently. And so I very much enjoyed that conversation. And I think it's just always fun to talk about it, these things with people who, as you just expressed, are both interested in the history and in the sort of practical, pastoral, theological realities of ordinary folk in the church. So it's been a great joy being with you. I've found it really stimulating. And it's funny, when you work along a lot on a book, you kind of think there's nothing really I'm going to learn about this after I've written it. And then you find yourself continually discovering things when you have discussions with smart people about it afterwards. So thank you so much for all the questions, but also just the really stimulating way you've engaged with it.
Yeah. I love it. Well, thanks for coming on, Andrew. For those of you who are watching online, hit subscribe button, like the video, share it around to those who you think would be interested, and make sure to follow us on the channel because we keep coming out with content just like this on theology, history, and the gifts of the Spirit. We are taping this program today. In an hour, we're interviewing David Platt, which is going to be fun. So make sure to subscribe so that you see when that interview comes out. So guys, thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next Monday and or Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Want to thank Kairos Classrooms for sponsoring this episode of Remnant Radio. And if you're out there, you've ever wondered, hey, I wonder if learning a biblical language would be a supplemental tool for me to help me in my biblical studies. Well, you need to check out Kairos Classrooms. They offer Greek and Hebrew classes that can help teach you and train you. It's a live classroom environment with actual students and actual live teachers, and they help teach you the biblical languages of Greek and Hebrew. And you need to check out Kairos Classrooms today. There's a link in the description, and you can use the promo code REMNANT to get 10% off. These classes are already crazy affordable, but with the promo code REMNANT, REMNANT, you'll get 10% off of Kairos Classroom. So check that out today. And thank you so much for Kairos for sponsoring this episode of Remnant Radio.